Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPBC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we'll be talking with Harriet Kerr, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Charlottesville. Welcome, Harriet.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here with us today. I really appreciate your coming in. Would you tell me a little bit of just sort of background on you and kind of what you know, how you came into doing this work and why?
Me personally?
Yes, ma'am. Tell me about you and then tell me about your organization.
So I have actually been involved. I'll go all the way back. I'm a UVA grad.
Oh, hey, me too.
Who then moved away for 30 years and
yeah,
came
I didn't
back.
Do the moving away part. I just stayed right
that
here.
Happens. But even ever since I was a student, I've just always been interested in international anything. Mm-hmm. So I've worked pretty much my whole career in nonprofits, but nonprofits doing work in the international sector. But
so, like, what? What are the kinds of?
I worked in international exchange, like international citizen exchange. I did that for about 20 years.
What does that mean?
I worked for an organization called the Friendship Force.
Okay.
And citizen exchange was like short-term homestay. Like, you go with a group of people from your hometown.
Like an exchange student goes to another country to go to school?
But they use the term citizen exchange,
okay,
meaning more for adults.
So okay.
And there's actually a group here in Central Virginia in Charlottesville that does the
really?
Same program. So go with maybe a group of 20 people from your hometown, go to a town in Japan, live with families for a week.
Wow, okay.
It was a lot of fun.
That sounds cool.
But when I left that, I started working for the International Rescue Committee, IRC, in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
I had been living in Atlanta for many years, and I worked with them for about 5.5 years, and then I got the opportunity to move to Charlottesville and become the director of the office here in Charlottesville.
Wow, we beat out Atlanta?
It was a promotion.
Okay, I was going to say, I hear there's a really good music scene down there.
It was a wonderful opportunity, and they, you know, and that was, I always tell people, you know, they always tell people make your connections in college and it'll help you in your career. And
that's
I was
right.
The only time it ever helped me in my career is when there was a job opening in Charlottesville and people knew
and
that
somebody
I had gone
said,
to UVA.
Hey,
you know Charlottesville, you've been at
there
UVA.
You go.
So it was great.
That's
yeah.
right.
So I came up here in 2010, so actually almost 6 years ago, just about 6 years ago now.
And we're so happy to have you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Tell me a little bit about IRC. Tell me about what the organization does and why you felt inclined to work for them.
Well, so the International Rescue Committee is actually, we're actually a very large international nonprofit headquartered in New York. The largest part of our work is overseas. We work in more than 40 countries around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And our focus is really on conflict and post-conflict or disaster, post-disaster
mm-hmm.
Situations.
You mean where you have an earthquake or a typhoon or something? And is that what you mean?
So
or?
I think originally we were really focused on what we call man-made disasters.
Oh, political disasters, as it were, war
right.
and
so,
things of that
exactly.
nature.
Exactly. And then we have now, actually since the time I've been working with IRC, we've started working in natural disaster situations
right.
as well, realizing that the skill set was essentially the same.
Well, of course, we have to manufacture some of our own.
Right.
I mean, there aren't really enough out there.
Exactly. So we're a humanitarian aid organization, meaning we're not really focused on long-term development. We're really focused on that immediate intervention.
Crisis management.
Exactly. Yeah, crisis situations. And then that's kind of our international programs. On the U.S. side, we are very specifically focused on refugee resettlement. And that's what our office here in Charlottesville does.
Which makes sense. You are helping those people who are in crises in other countries, and part of your helping them is sometimes getting them somewhere safe.
Yes, exactly. And we think we have an interesting model. The way we approach it is we're working with people during their displacement overseas,
mm-hmm.
and then we kind of see them all the way through that long, long process of eventually coming to kind of safety and security in somewhere permanent.
So how, for example, if you began working with a family today in another country in a crisis situation, and that family was to ultimately make it all the way through the process and
yeah.
be settled here, how long would you be working with that particular family?
I don't know. It's not quite that directly connected.
Oh, I see.
I mean, there's that medium part mm-hmm. of, you know, there's sort of they're in displacement and one arm is working with them, and then they, and once that, resettlement process begins, mm-hmm. there's a big chunk of UN and American government mm-hmm. stuff in the middle. And then they kind of come to us. But, you know, I just heard the statistic this week that the average time of displacement is something like 17 years.
That 17 years? Refugees,
yeah. And,
what do you mean the average time of displacement? What is displacement when you say
meaning,
that?
Meaning, so when we, the population people we are, that we call refugee, so there's the kind of colloquial term refugee, mm-hmm. but when we really talk about somebody with a legal status as a mm-hmm. refugee, it means someone who has, the key thing is you actually have to cross an international border. You okay. have to have left your home country, mm-hmm. Been forced out of your home country.
Or fled.
Fled. And the key concept there is for fear of persecution.
Uh-huh.
So when we use the term refugee, we're not talking about people who may have left. And not that these are not invalid reasons, but they didn't leave because they want a chance for better education or there's no jobs.
Right.
But you have a well-founded fear of persecution is the exact terminology.
What that makes me think of mm-hmm. is the Holocaust. Makes me think about
absolutely.
People fleeing
sure.
Germany.
Right. So, but you have to cross that border. Mm-hmm. The next country, you know, wherever you land is your country of asylum.
Okay.
If you are actually safe and you can stay in that country, that's where you stay. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a place that, you know, doesn't give you any kind of rights, you're not eligible for medical care or education mm-hmm. or you're not given a work permit. You're
right.
kind of in this limbo state.
Right.
That's how people become eventually eligible for what we call third country resettlement, which would be, for example, coming to the U.S. or Canada. Or
okay.
somewhere else.
I understand.
So, what was the original,
question was, what do you mean by displacement? You gave me a 17-year average figure, and I'm trying to figure out.
Okay. So for example, we can talk about some of the groups that are here in Charlottesville now. So one of the big groups that we're kind of finishing up with now are the Bhutanese. Bhutanese were...
I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. So there's Bhutan, the happy country.
Bhutan.
Yeah.
Where's Bhutan?
Nepal, Tibet... India down in there.
God, I'm so ignorant of this kind of thing.
Yeah,
I'm
really,
so sorry.
But they were a minority ethnic okay. population that had been living in one area of Bhutan
okay.
for over three centuries.
All right. That's a long time on the family farm.
That was a long time. And the Bhutanese government, for various political reasons, mm-hmm. basically pushed the entire population out and they were pushed back into Nepal. And they're ethnic. They came from Nepal mm-hmm. three centuries before.
Right.
So they speak the Nepali language.
Their ancestors are from Nepal.
Right, but no one, you know,
but they're,
went back.
They've
right.
lost their ties to that country because
so
it's been 300 years.
They got pushed into refugee camps in Nepal.
Mm.
They were in... That entire population was in refugee camps in Nepal for 18 years before they were granted the right to even be resettled somewhere else.
You mean they were, like, living in tents for 18 years?
Huts, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the entire population, because Nepal was unable, did not want to or did not feel capable of absorbing them. I mean, they've got their own economic problems.
Right.
It was a large number. It was, I don't even know, 60,000, 75,000, something like that. So an entire generation grew up in refugee camps.
What's the population of Nepal? What kind
That's
of
a good question. I don't know.
Percentage are we talking about there? We're not talking
about... Also Nepal, of course, spread over a huge geographic area, so I
right.
think fairly thinly populated.
Right.
So, you know, 18 years before they started coming to the U.S., so the last people that are coming now have probably been living in refugee camps for like 25 years. So that's
there are
one
children
extreme.
That were born in those camps and
oh, totally.
Grew up in them.
Most of the young people know no other life, right? And then, you know, kind of the shorter term end might be like the Iraqi refugees. And they were in displaced, you know, after the breakdown of Iraq. They were probably, even it, the time it took them to get to the U.S. was still probably... The fastest ones was 3 to 4 years. So we're still resettling refugees out of Iraq now. And what's this like?
So if you're just
10, 15 years later,
if you're just tuning in, my guest is Harriet Kerr, who is from the IRC. I always thought it was the International Refugee Commission. Guess I'm wrong. It's the International Rescue
Committee.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. and you were talking about the Iraqi refugees.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit more about their situation. I understand what happened. You know, I sort of get what you're saying about the people in Bhutan. It was essentially an ethnic sort of political, we don't like this ethnic group thing, so now we're going to throw them all out of our country. What's the story with Iraq? In Iraq, are we talking about more, you know, people who cooperated with the U.S.? I mean, is it like Vietnam, or how does that work?
There's kind of two different groups. So there's, in Charlottesville, we actually have a lot of what we call SIVs, who are the, they're Iraqis and Afghans, who worked for the American military or U.S. government.
What does SIV stand for?
It stands for Special Immigrant Visas. They're technically not, they're not refugees.
Right, they have a
by
visa.
By definition. They apply through a special visa program. Mm-hmm. They actually get legal permanent residence, green cards.
Right.
As soon as they come. But they're granted that status because they've become endangered by their association with the U.S.
In other words, when the U.S. was in Iraq and these people were citizens in Iraq, they assisted the U.S. government in some way, such that the government that remains there, they sort of became persona non grata.
Right. So and they have a special
which sounds a lot like what happened
status.
In Vietnam.
Yes, but then there's also Iraqi refugees, and I'm not an expert on Iraq. I think a lot of what's happening in Iraq is the kind of different ethnic, the collapse of the different ethnic groups and the pushing of, you know, the Sunnis and the Shias and people. It's a lot of internal displacement, but if you talk to the Iraqi refugees, most of them left after an act of violence against someone in their family. So, for example, one of my staff members is Iraqi, and you know, her brother was murdered on the street. Then they started threatening other members of the family. They got a taxi
and
crossed the border. They left. So most people have those very specific kinds of stories. Yeah,
I understand. Well, tell me a little bit about what IRC does for these people when they arrive here.
Mm-hmm.
What does the organization do? What does it provide them?
So we're basically, we are responsible for making the arrangements to get them settled in their new home.
Mm-hmm.
So before they come, we're already working, preparing, you know, getting an apartment ready for them, furnishing it. We go to the airport and meet them, bring them home.
Right.
And then, you know, right at the beginning, there's this very intense flurry of services, helping people, you know, they go to the health department to get immunizations and a health screening, apply for social security cards, take the kids to get them enrolled in school.
Mm-hmm.
Refugees arrive with, it's a special humanitarian status. It's actually not even a visa. It's a special government status. The program is run by the State Department. They come in. And so we kind of do all these things to get them initially established. And then the next thing, immediately, within a few weeks, we start talking to all the adults in the family about getting jobs.
Right.
Because the expectation is we have a small amount of funding to kind of get them up and going. But the expectation is within 3 to 4 months of arrival, the family should be economically self-sufficient through employment.
And is that working?
I would say within about the first 6 months, we probably get 80 to 85% of the families self-sufficient.
Really? Where do you find these people jobs? They probably don't speak English.
Some do. Many do not. I'll say Charlottesville is a kind of interesting, but you know, Charlottesville has a very thriving service economy.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot of needs for people to like work in the hotels, work in food service. Though, you know, a lot of it is very much entry level jobs.
Right. Sure.
Which can actually be hard for some of the people who are educated trying to, you know, and really want to turn to that. But
right. If you were a doctor in Iraq, it's would you like fries with that? It's not your life.
And a lot of times that's what we end up kind of needing people to do because we, you know, no one's supporting them for a year while they look for that.
Sure.
So that's kind of working with more educated and professional people can be often more challenging than people who've never actually worked in the formal economy before.
Right.
Both are challenging, but we have a lot of employers who really like working with refugees. They often are very reliable employees. They're thankful to have the job. They're thankful to be in a safe place and to be able to kind of form a steady, reliable life. But we do a lot of that. And then we want to continue working with the, especially people with some of those skills to try and help them move up after they've been here a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. We've been having a lot of fun. The Charlottesville has this great, like the GO programs. They've been doing, you know, these bus driver trainings. And I don't know.
I don't know about that. Tell me about that.
Called Growing Opportunity. Mm-hmm. This is a city program. They've been offering like free trainings. They've got Go Electric, Go Driver, Go.
I love Charlottesville.
It's really cool. Yeah, it's out of the downtown. It's out of the, I guess it's the Office of Economic. Uh-huh. What is it? Economic something.
It's the
Economic
city.
Development. It's the city. And we've had a lot of, we've got some bus drivers now, like refugee bus drivers who went through that program. We've got, we're actually helping a couple of the SIV guys. Do truck driver training at PVCC. That's something new that's just starting. So, you know, we kind of try and encourage people to get a first job, and then we'll help you work up. So, yeah.
This all makes me kind of think about the politicization of this issue, however.
Yes.
There's a lot of political pushback, and what you're talking about, I can just hear some conservatives now going, they're taking our jobs.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's kind of interesting because whenever something appears online, there's always someone who writes on it, they're just here to take our jobs. And I guess this is just my personal question. Why would an employer hire someone who doesn't speak English if there's 10 Americans wanting that same job lined up? I mean, the reality is, I think a lot of the jobs that immigrants tend to fill are the jobs that are harder to fill. And also people hoping for a slightly more reliable workforce or people that will stay in the jobs for a little longer. You know, and I would say, you know, Charlottesville has such a low unemployment rate. I mean,
right.
We're like under 4% here.
Right.
And so they're, you know, the need to fill that service economy in most areas. What's interesting economically in Charlottesville is that there's very little manufacturing here. So, and that's in most cities, that's also, you know, that ends up being an entry-level thing.
You mean in most cities where there's a more of a manufacturing
yeah.
sector, that's
like
one of the
Richmond.
Places you place these people?
You know, over, like, there's a refugee resettlement agency in Harrisonburg,
mm-hmm.
and basically everybody's getting employed in poultry processing.
Right.
Actually, in Atlanta, where I came from, that was a huge employer as well. Those are not, like, jobs that people are dying to get, but they're important jobs.
Right.
They're
well,
important,
they need to be
secure
done.
Jobs, and they need to be done.
And
yeah.
you're saying that the IRC people, the folks who are sort of settling here, are more reliable as employees? Maybe because they don't have a lot of choice.
I think that it's a lot that, yeah. And I think they don't have a lot of choice, and they have no fallback. I mean, they're starting from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
They have to. The rent has to be paid.
Right.
There's, you know, no one's going to step in and help. They don't have, you know, extended family that might,
oh,
you
right.
know, that may be, they, you know, that can perhaps help them.
Mm-hmm.
So they know they really have to make it work.
They got to sink or swim, so
yep.
they're swimming hard.
Exactly. Yeah.
I got it. I understand.
And, you know, the other thing is, too, you know, what's important is, of course, the refugees have legal status to work. I mean, when they arrive in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
they are, you know, there's no issues about their work eligibility.
We're not talking about somebody who's an illegal worker.
No.
They're
right.
They have a government permit that allows
right. I mean,
them
they
to do
they're
that.
On they enter on a path to citizenship.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. Well, I understand there's been some action in the General Assembly this year that affects refugees.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about what's going on there?
You know, the whole issue that's really come into the press, focusing on Syrian refugees, I think immigration in general has been front and center for quite a while. What's become interesting since the key event was really early September,
mm-hmm.
when that image of that little boy drowned drowned on the beach in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
That image just electrified the world and just became a focal point for all of this discussion about the refugee crisis.
Now, I know what you're talking about, but some people might not know what you're talking about.
Do you think there's people who haven't seen that picture?
There might be people who, I mean, I have this vague notion of having seen that picture, but it's not.
Really? Okay.
And maybe everybody else is much better educated than me, but.
Well, as this whole.
They probably are.
I think what happened, you know, the Syrians, so it's coming out of the Syrian crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So there are more than 10 million Syrians have been displaced from their homes.
Mm-hmm. And they're fleeing Greece.
It's more complicated than that.
Okay.
So about 6 million of those are actually displaced within Syria.
Okay.
So there's a huge displacement there. And then about 4 million have actually left the country and have come into the surrounding countries. Mm-hmm. So they're in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Turkey. Huge, but I mean, 4 million people. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And so you've got like Lebanon, where 20% of the population of Lebanon are Syrian refugees.
Now, see, that's an interesting number.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Huge. Jordan, a huge proportion of the population of Jordan are Iraqi and Syrian refugees.
Don't you think that xenophobia sort of grows when you reach a population marker when you have just a few people coming in? I think that, you know, the general knee-jerk reaction is not. It's not scary. There's only a few of them.
Well, it's hard.
But when you have a lot of them, it becomes.
But I think those countries, you know, they recognize these people as their. I mean, it'd be like Canadians coming here. I mean, they recognize them as their neighbors, but these are not countries with stable floor. You know, these are countries that are. They're not. You know, they're working as hard as they can just to make.
They don't have 50 jobs in poultry processing.
Exactly, lives for their own people, and they. They want to do what they can for their friends and neighbors, but they're being overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, this huge number in Turkey. You know,
How does this tie into that picture?
So you've got this huge displacement of people into the, so we're just now, this week, we're celebrating the 5th anniversary of the Syrian uprising.
Mm-hmm.
So people have been coming out for 5 years. The kind of normal paths in kind of the way refugee resettlement works is, you know, people kind of come out, they get registered by the UN. It's UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees handles, you know, they tend to go to these pressure points. They register the cases, take the first testimony of persecution, kind of document, are they actually eligible for status as refugees? Once you cross that international border, you fall under that kind of jurisdiction of the UN. And then, you know, usually it's sort of they might set up camps, they might set up relief centers, the non-governmental organizations, the NGOs all kind of start coming in with relief programs, and then people are sitting. They're sitting there. They're not allowed to work. They may or may not be in a camp. I mean, there's actually more people in urban settings than in camp settings, but they're taking up all the rent, the housing that's available in small towns or in cities. And they're not allowed to work. They're living off their savings. Things are getting more and more dire, and they don't see a path. So, you know, ideally in a situation like that, you want to set up what we call orderly departure, which is what the U.S. does. You know, you say, okay, these people can't go home. They can't stay here forever. We're going to start setting up a program to transfer them safely in an orderly fashion to the resettlement countries. There's maybe roughly 10 countries around the world, Europe, Canada, U.S., Australia. We're going to start that. It hasn't been happening. You know, things have been dragging. And what happens, it's like, to my mind, it's like the pressure is building up and people are desperate. They can't stay where they are. They don't see a way to go somewhere else.
Right.
So what's happening, they're getting on dinghies on the beaches in Turkey and trying to get to Greece, which is an EU country, as an entry. And so then you hear all of a sudden this crazy stuff with the smugglers taking people to the beaches of Lesbos and other Greek islands as a way to enter some other route because the kind of orderly system isn't functioning.
It's overwhelmed.
Right. So it was, I think, really in September, early August, early September, you started seeing from Europe these pictures of these, you know, just these dinghies landing. And then, of course, you know, people are coming from other places. Mm-hmm. And that's totally, you know, that's just a very, you know, this is this horrendous
So basically what we have
in Europe.
Families from Syria that are displaced that then flee to somewhere like Turkey.
Yeah.
But then they're stuck and they're not going to get out of there. And
they see no solution.
And they have no way to get a job. Yeah. And so they get in a little rubber raft and try to head over to Greece.
Right.
And then they die. And we end up with this picture.
Well, that was, I think most of them don't die, but people do die.
Some of them do.
And some of them do. And then, of course, they're landing in Greece with, you know, there's no facilities, you know. So, so there's that. And then I think in the U.S., now that is not what's happening in the U.S., but people see those pictures.
Right.
People definitely, there's definitely been a lot of misinformation that that's what's happening in the U.S. I've seen pictures. People were taking pictures of dinghies landing in Greece and putting them on Facebook and, you know, the one.
As though
they were.
The U.S. were being invaded.
Yes, as though they're landing on the beaches in California, which is not what's happening.
Right.
But, you know, so there's that. And then, you know, here the U.S. is still trying to do this. But I think that kind of imagery. And then also, and then once Paris happened, the attacks in Paris happened, things really exploded.
Oh, I want to talk about Paris. But we still haven't kind of tied this thread in yet.
Yes.
What I want to get back to is what's happening in the Virginia legislature. But so, wait, before you do that, I think it is time for us to take one of those happy little breaks that we have to take in radio.
Yeah.
So ponder that, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
Okay, so if you're just tuning in, this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes, and my guest today is Harriet Kerr, who's the executive director of the International Rescue Committee in Charlottesville. And so, Harriet, we were just about to talk about what's happened in the General Assembly this session.
Yeah.
And we started with, a little boy who's photographed dead on the beach in Greece. And how does that end up in our state house?
Well, I think I believe that kind of imagery that was on the evening news and everything kind of fed into kind of our pre-existing national discussions on immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Why didn't it feed into them like, oh, my God, those poor people? Let's.
Well, I think that definitely happened.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there was a lot that was one response.
Right.
But then I think another response was these people are just arriving. No one knows who they are. They don't have ID in Europe.
Right.
And that this is just open doors. We don't know
it
who's coming
terrorists.
In. That could happen here. I mean, I think that was the association. That could happen here. People are just arriving in America as refugees. We don't know who they are. And then
it's a long way from Greece to Virginia Beach.
You know, yes, but on TV, no.
I see.
In TV land and in media land, I think those bridges get...
The distance is shortened. I see.
I think the distance gets shortened.
Well, maybe, I don't know where Bhutan is, so you know, maybe there's people who don't know.
And so that happened, and I think that discussion had already... There was a little bit of that discussion happening, and then following the attacks in Paris in December, it heightened. So what happened in the U.S. is...
The Virginia legislation that we're talking about right now happen after the Paris?
So that was just
stuff?
So Paris was,
December? All right, so let's hit Paris before we get to the legislation.
Well, I don't want to talk so much specifically about Paris. I think Paris, because of those attacks in Paris, that kind of put front and center this discussion about who are the immigrants coming into our countries? Are they terrorists?
So basically we had two unrelated things. We had a little boy who got photographed dead on the beach in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had this terror attack in Paris. And the terror attack in Paris, we're talking about a bunch of people with machine guns coming in and shooting up the movie theater. Yes. Or was it the opera?
It was the concert hall and several cafes. And but I think the link is there are terrorists. There are terrorists in our midst.
Those things became.
How did they come? All these
together in our.
And this
our
is
minds.
Europe, right? We're still talking about Europe,
right? Okay.
But all these people are coming into Europe. We don't know who they are. You know, there's that, and then that gets kind of transposed to. They're coming to America too.
Okay,
you know, that who's coming to America? You know,
right?
refugees are coming to America.
Right.
Where are they coming from? They're
right.
coming from Syria.
Okay.
Syria is a dangerous place. You know, so
right.
that kind of fed, you know, so that kind of, yeah, just got into the conversation.
So what happened in the state legislature?
So what happened first, I'm going to back up, is not long after, you know, we had this list of governors who tried to stop, you know.
Yeah, I remember
so there
that.
Were the 31, and this happened literally within like 2 or 3 days, of 31.
I'm betting McAuliffe was not one of them.
No. So, but they were all Republican.
Right.
But 31 governors who all came out with statements saying that specifically Syrian refugees cannot enter my state.
Wow, okay.
That sounds
kind of
like, the first,
you know, black
salvo.
People can't go to school.
That's exactly right. So that has led to a lot of issues.
Is that being litigated?
And so the state of Texas has there's a lawsuit, active lawsuit by the state of Texas against the State Department, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the IRC.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's being litigated in some other one or two other states. So, of course, you know, there's several issues here, but one is immigration law is federal law, not state law.
Right.
Second, civil rights law, civil rights law does not allow discrimination.
National origin.
On national
sure.
origin or ethnicity or any of
yeah,
the.
Yeah, I see problems for that law
right.
ahead.
So there's issues there. What the attack most of the governors are saying that you cannot keep people from coming into your state. What you can do is instruct your state agencies to deny them services. So what you see is in some of those states, the refugees can come in, but they're not allowed to apply for public benefits. They're not being allowed to access the health department or any state services.
Sounds a little bit
services.
Like what Virginia's doing with driver's licenses. I have lots of Mexican and Latin American mm-hmm. clients
yeah.
who are here for a variety of reasons, some of them yeah. legally, some of them not legally.
Right.
But it's extremely difficult for people to get a driver's
yes,
license.
It is.
And
I think the
goal there is let's, you know, deny these people licenses, we'll arrest
right.
them because they have to drive, because
right.
they have to feed their families.
Right.
And then eventually they'll get the message and leave, or we'll deport them because we've arrested them and incarcerated them so
right.
many times.
Yeah.
Now they're criminals because they drove.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that sounds kind of similar.
So yes, I think you're absolutely
Only
right.
Only the difference legally is that here we're talking about people who are legally present.
Right.
And in right. the driver's license cases, most of the time we're talking about someone who's undocumented.
Right. So there was that. And then kind of what we saw coming up in the General Assembly, there's some kind of anti-refugee legislation that's sort of being picked up in different states. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple bills that came up in the state house. But fortunately, they did not make it out of committee.
Okay.
They did not make it out of committee for this session.
They didn't pass, but what were they?
Oh, gosh, I'm trying to remember what they were. It was, one was that if there were any the refugees, you had to, register a plan for their resettlement, like, I don't remember, like 60 days before they arrived,
mm-hmm.
that they would have to be background checked by the state police, that they had to go in every month and re-register with the state police.
Like, almost like they were
things
sex
like
offenders?
That. Yeah, you that know, kind of the, stuff. It was mostly that.
Wow.
That kind of stuff. And we are definitely seeing that kind of legislation popping up in other states as well. Yeah,
but those changes did not pass in Virginia law this session.
Well, what you know, there were, I think, two or three of them. They got into a committee. The committee said combine them into one, which was done,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't. They just did a voice vote. You know, so who knows?
Right.
Who said what. It didn't get it. It didn't get make it out of the committee to actually be presented on the floor.
I see.
That doesn't mean it couldn't pop up again next year.
I'm kind
year.
Of surprised. I mean, the Virginia yeah. General Assembly is so conservative. I'm kind of surprised they didn't.
Yeah, well, we're
didn't make it out of the House. I could see them not getting signed into law, but
no, because you know, I think the governor would have vetoed. Because Governor McAuliffe has come out as in support of refugees, thankfully. Yeah. So, but it's definitely of concern. It's of concern.
So I understand there's some legislation that's working its way through on a national level as well. I think there have been some very recent developments. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on there?
There was a federal bill that came out in the fall that actually got kind of it was specifically Syrian and Iraqi refugees that actually got passed by the House and then died in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of concern that it was going to get attached as a rider to the budget bill, must-pass budget bill. And there was a lot of worry about that, and thankfully that didn't happen.
Right.
But there's a new one now that's just come out that's in the House Judiciary Committee in Washington that's kind of really, it's called the... really frightening. It's called the Refugee Program Integrity and Restoration Act, which attempts to take away from the right now the authority for bringing in refugees actually is a presidential. It's a president. I mean, the Congress reviews the program, mm-hmm. makes a recommendation, but the president actually every year has to sign an mm-hmm. authorization. It's presidential authorization. So this bill would try to significantly reduce the number of refugees coming in. Right now, refugees come in on that status. They're eligible to apply for green cards for legal permanent residence. Mm-hmm. After 1 year, this would deny them that for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
They would have to reapply every year for their status. They'd have to document that they're still fall as refugees. They would have to register with law enforcement. It puts and then what it's also attempting to do is put onto the resettlement agencies that if any refugee comes in and commits a crime or an act of terrorism, that the resettlement agency is responsible.
Oh, they're trying to kill organizations like IRC.
Right, exactly. So knowing full well that all of this work is done by private nonprofits.
Right.
So
if they can make your liability so large that they can't, but you can't insure it, then
exactly.
you won't be able to operate.
Exactly.
And then they can stop this from.
Well, and of course, knowing full well that, you know, there's been no act of terrorism in the U.S.
It wasn't domestic in a while.
Well, so what we would say is there are no immigrants to the United States that are more carefully vetted than refugees. Their application process, you know, we say for the Syrians is 18 to 24 months of scrutiny and vetting overseas
before they
get on that plane.
So that's that in-between part where you were saying you might be working with somebody over in Bhutan, and you might then at some after some period of time there, they would be dealing with government folks. And then once they went through that process and they were cleared to come, then they'd be back. Maybe you guys would be helping them here.
So they're kind of under the auspices of the UN. At some point, they get referred. They might be invited. Mm-hmm. You actually get invited to apply for the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. Mm. So they may do that. But once they then get referred and they're kind of in the pipeline for the U.S., there's a very intense program. I mean, there's medical screenings. They have to be re-interviewed. You know, so already to have refugee status with the UN, they had to kind of tell their story, give a lot of details. All that goes back around again. Every refugee coming to the U.S. has a face-to-face interview with someone from the Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
They go back over every detail of their flight story. They ask them questions about every member of their family.
Mm-hmm.
They do like their whole genealogy or the family
sort of
trees.
Like an intensive cross-examination.
Extremely intensive. They go back over everything face to face. They go through multiple security checks. There's just this very, very, very careful vet. And for the people coming from the Middle East, you know, like Syria or Iraq, it's multiple background checks.
Right.
You know, just every database, you know, you can probably think of. And so when they, you know, get on that plane to finally come to the U.S., and also knowing, of course, when they arrive, they can't just randomly come as they want. They're being received by a resettlement agency.
Right.
They're, you know, kind of in this network. I mean, there's no one coming on a fiancé visa or work visa or any other kind of visa that's been checked as thoroughly as a refugee.
Right.
So to then, you know, with like this, the governor's pushing back against refugees, saying, oh, they might be terrorists.
Right.
You know, nothing is 100%, but you're kind of...
But it's more likely somebody coming on a short-term visa is going to be a terrorist than somebody coming on a refugee visa.
If terrorists wanted to infiltrate the U.S., there's a lot easier ways to do it than through the... And also knowing that those people coming as refugees were sitting in a camp or in displacement in terrible circumstances for years before they even got to that point.
Like, so it'd be a fairly long-term plan if you were going to...
It'd be a serious long-term plan.
I think I'll spend the next 15 years living in a hut.
Exactly. Or to be living in a refugee camp in Turkey for five years.
Or I could just get a tourist visa.
If you could. Or a fiancé visa, but that's, you know... But there's just a lot easier ways.
Right.
But they're targeting this program because it's visible and it does, you know, rely on, just because the Syrian refugees are in the news so much, it's easy rhetoric.
Right. One of the things I hear sometimes when I talk, when I sort of drill down into a conversation with someone I disagree with politically, one of the things I often hear, and I'm a far left winger, so you can imagine who I'm disagreeing with politically, we end up having a debate about, from my perspective, the question is this right or, you know, is this wrong? Are we being mean-spirited? Are we right? You know, from the other perspective, one of the things I hear a lot is, yeah, but don't you think these beliefs are sincere? Don't you think that the reasons behind these politicians' actions, that they believe the things they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I always found that to be an interesting dichotomy. I think both things are true. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are sincere, and they're still wrong.
I think
there's a feeling that some of this is pandering. Some of this is, you know, some of the politicians know good and well that, you know, these people aren't really a danger, but it's a great election move. It's a great political move to throw a big fit about it.
I think it gives
you a lot of points.
Yeah.
But some of those politicians are legitimately concerned about this.
Well, I think there's two things going on. One is I do think there's pandering in that, when Chris Christie comes out and says that, you know, when somebody tried to tell you, said, well, what about like the 3-year-old unaccompanied Syrian orphan?
Right.
And he's like, not even them, you know, that they're, you know, they're, I think some of it is posturing that the need to keep America safe at all costs is a real concern they feel that that's an important stance to take.
Well, it's
right
all leftover from 9/11, right? I mean, we had a huge cultural shift at that moment.
I think Paris brought it back up again.
Yeah,
so I think they do see that as like that, and I think this rhetoric is we've seen it come out like in Texas that rhetoric of it's, you know, I'm the governor, it's my job to keep the people of my state safe at all costs, no matter what. So that's, you know, I think that's what they can say is the good. On the other hand, what we see is there's a lot of ignorance of what's actually, you know, so like these bills that come before the state legislature that say the refugees are coming, the state police have to do another background check. The state police don't want to do a background. You know, the state police know that any check they would be able to do has already been done.
Right.
Their
background check is going to be...
Yeah.
Nothing compared to the background checks that have already been done because they don't have the kind of access to the information that the international folks will have in the 2 years they were vetting them.
Yeah. I mean, because all this was handled by Homeland Security.
Right.
I mean, all of that entire process is under the jurisdiction of Homeland Security already. So they're just sort of false roadblocks. I mean, the state police have, you know, those guys are interested in other things. But they're interested in things that kind of happen after people get, you know, other things.
Right.
But these kind of roadblocks. So...
it's sort of like saying, you know, if you're going to run an abortion clinic, you have to have, you know, this kind of hallway and, this, you know,
but it's for the safety of women.
That's right. Yeah. It's for the safety. Sure. It's for the safety.
I think some of these governors, some of them do know what they're saying. And I think some of them really don't know enough about how the program works. So one of the things that those of us who advocate for refugees, we are trying very hard to educate our elected officials on how the program actually runs.
Well, let's... This is one of those moments where I have to say, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And this is Straight Talk. I'm Andre Hakes. And my guest is Harriet Kerr, who is the International Rescue Committee
yeah.
Executive Director in Charlottesville. Let me ask you this question. Let's imagine that the camp of people who are supporting very anti-refugee legislation mm-hmm. is divided, right, into two parts. There's the part that is doing this because it's great political theater, mm-hmm. and they think it'll help them get reelected with their base.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the part who really think there's a grave danger here.
Mm-hmm.
What would you want to tell the people who really think there's a grave danger here? What kind of things would you like them to understand about this, if indeed they were engaging in good faith mm-hmm. in the conversation?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think what we want to... I will add
it's a tough question.
I also maybe in a subset of mm-hmm. that is the concern about Islam.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So there's that fear also that, you know, we're... because that's one of this federal bill that's coming. One of the other elements of it is prioritizing religious minorities, mm-hmm. meaning religious minorities coming out of it doesn't say it, but out of Muslim countries.
Right. We want to help the Christians who are trying to flee the Muslim countries.
I think,
but we don't have any religious discrimination.
what we want people to know is that. You know, basically, refugees in these have built America, right? I mean, we have a history that we see this. This is who we are as Americans. We are a welcoming country. We recognize that waves of refugees and immigrants have built our country. That's our heritage, and that kind of our ability to bring these people in and absorb them and make them American. You know, in another generation, as people kind of integrate into our country, that's part of what makes our country great. But I think also that these people are fleeing horrible, horrible situations. I mean, just immense amounts of suffering. All they want to do is start their lives again, just, go somewhere where it's safe and quiet. They're not trying to make all kinds of trouble here. They just want a place where they can raise their children, their kids can have school, where they can have jobs and just kind of become part of our community. I think Charlottesville is a really good example. I mean, people ask me like how many people are here already, and we actually don't know how many refugees are in Charlottesville. We know how many have come. We don't know how many are still here, but we probably have somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 refugees that are here making your home, and it's really woven themselves into the fabric of our community. I think we try and talk about that. And then we also just try and talk about how safe the program is and how carefully, these people are vetted, and how much we, feel like due diligence is really being done before they ever set foot in the United States. We talk about that as well.
So it sort of sounds like the things you would like mm-hmm. those people who are listening and really thinking about this issue to understand are, one, the sort of humanitarian point of this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, people are dying and suffering, and you know, we as a country need to be trying to help those people,
mm-hmm.
in part because of who we are mm-hmm. In terms of our own immigration history, and in part just in terms of who we are as people.
Yeah.
And the other part of what you would want them to understand is that the danger is actually very low in this group.
Yes.
And it's that second part that I think is maybe where I suspect the education can be made with that group of opposition, with the opposition that has real concerns. I mean, mm-hmm. the people who are pandering and exploiting the situation for political gain, they understand, or they're not going to care that this is the right thing to do. But the people who care about the right thing to do but are just afraid, it sounds like, what you want them to understand is that in terms of risk— It's a pretty low risk group.
Yeah.
Now that isn't to say that there will never be refugee who commits a serious crime or an act of terror. There certainly could be.
Yeah.
But when you're weighing the risk associated with various groups at the outset.
And if you look at the numbers of refugees, you know, we resettled 70,000 refugees last year in the U.S., and that's been going on for years. The, the huge hundreds of thousands of refugees who have come under the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program over whatever, we're going back to the Vietnam War, after the Vietnam War, and, you know, with you know, very, I don't know if there's never, I can't think of an exact of domestic terrorism that's come out of refugee. I couldn't say never, but that.
Well, I'm sure they commit crimes, but so does your next door neighbor. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, you know,
exactly.
I'm sure they get a DUI. I'm sure they get.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But if you look at the number of people and the low risk, you know, this is a this is a low risk population.
Mm-hmm.
It's very low risk. Yeah.
I understand. I think maybe one of the other things they might be thinking about is the sort of they're taking our jobs thing, right? The sort of economic argument that. You know, we don't want too many of these people here because then we'll lose jobs
you know,
to them.
What's interesting, what you see with the refugees as well as immigrants is there's a higher rate of starting up businesses and entrepreneurship among immigrants than among native-born
really
Americans.
Point.
You know,
and
you look around. You know, and of course, with you know, it's kind of interesting with IRC. Like, you know, we like to claim, Andy Grove, who. You know, as a founder of Intel, you know, as a refugee, you know, the Google guys or, refugee. So you've got this, but it's very common. Even if you just look around Charlottesville, you know, we've got, you know, of course the famous ones over here, you know, the Marco and Luca dumpling.
Oh yes. Love Marco and Luca dumplings.
Refugee.
Probably. Well, you know what? I bet I will be eating Marco and Luca dumplings tonight.
Yeah.
Before my wife and I go out to the movies.
There you
I
go.
Bet we will, 'cause it's like her favorite thing.
And it's right there.
That's right.
But you know, if you just look in chart, look at that. We've got, Alma and Mela Hair Salon. We've got Larry Zotto. It's Larry Zotto. Yeah, there's
Larry Zotto sounds very
Yasha
homegrown.
And Sasha, you know.
Not so much, huh?
You know, but we've got businesses here. And then, you know, and I think that's very common because people, you know, many of these people, especially with the Syrians, you know, that we hope will be coming, you know, it was a pretty middle class country. And you've got a lot of people coming who had their own businesses at home. They that's all they want to start one here. You know, so, you know, I think at the initial, you know, there's kind of as people integrated in. But there's a lot of entrepreneurship out there
argument,
as well.
Statistically, your counter argument to their take on our jobs is they're making more jobs.
Well, I mean, I can't spout these statistics, but if when you look at models, people in areas where there's kind of more open immigration policies like that, you actually have business development. It's actually good for the economy. And there's, I think the concept, actually some of these people who push back, they're coming and they sit around on welfare.
Yeah, right. That is a perception.
You know, or on public assistance. And that's not what's happening. And even, you know, people that have some assistance when they first come, they'll tell you that the refugees get off of assistance and stay off assistance at a higher rate than the general public, you know, because that's not what they're here for. They're here to make a new life. They want to stand on their own two feet. They want their kids to succeed.
Well, and it may be that if they're coming from overseas and Homeland Security is involved and international agencies like yours are involved, there is more support for them to get off welfare than there is for Americans.
Well, you know, that's you know,
welfare.
You know, we do say, you know, one of the strengths of our programs, we do have this ability to work very intensively with people right at the beginning when they come. So they don't have to go out, you know, and find their own job. We help them. We help make those connections for them. We support them through their hiring process and through their first couple months to make sure they, you know, they're able to really figure out how to be a good employee. And, you know, that is a model. It's kind of interesting because, yeah, I mean, there's some people here in Charlottesville saying that's the model we need to actually replicate for
Americans.
For Americans. So, you know, and I think also some of those, you know, but I mean, we're there to help, but it's short term, you know, it's.
Well, the Americans usually have some kind of alternative, right? I mean, you know, yeah. and the refugees don't have much in the way right. of alternatives.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
They have families. They have...
Well, I think that's a lot of it. Yeah, that they can't, you know... Right, they can't take an assistance check and then live in grandma's basement.
Right.
And that is not ideal, but right. it's something. The refugee, like, you cannot pay a rent in Charlottesville with a public assistance check. You've got... If you don't have income coming in from employment that you can...
But I mean, that's a function of Charlottesville. I mean,
I think anywhere. I don't. Really? I'm sorry. You know, I'm even in Atlanta where the rents were less expensive.
Yeah,
you couldn't pay your rent with public. The public assistance levels are so low. I don't know of any place where you can actually live on that and pay rent in a regular non-subsidized unit. I don't think even in New York City you could do that.
Well, New York City's not a good example either.
No, but I mean, I'm trying to be places where...
You can't rent a closet in New York.
It's not a sustainable model right. if you don't have family, you know, or some other support that can cover some of the expenses.
Some other people helping, yeah. No,
that's what I think. But definitely not for the refugees. So they really have to get on their feet really quickly.
Well, we are just a few minutes before the top of the hour here when we're going to have to end. This may be an unfair question at this point because you don't have a lot of time left to answer it. But can you give us a little snapshot of what you see coming down the road for your organization? Do you know what you'll be doing this time next year? Do you have any crystal ball for us?
I can only say what I hope is that we're doing that. We're continuing to thrive and that we're having a lot more Syrians and some of these really suffering populations that the system is loosening up so that we're settling them here in Charlottesville, which is what we want and what we believe the people of Charlottesville want as well.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate all the good work you're doing.
Thank you.
And I'm really glad that you decided to come in today and talk to me.
Thanks for having me.
So carry on. This has been Straight Talk with Andre Hakes on 94.7 WPVC. And I am wrapping up now. Tune in next Saturday at 10. We will be speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor of Slate Magazine and an avid court watcher, about the vacancy left on the U.S. Supreme Court by the death of Justice Scalia, President Obama's nominee, Judge Merrick Garland, and the accompanying what I'm calling the Cold War in the Senate. I'm Andre Hakes, signing off. Have a great weekend, y'all.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.